Guess what?
What?
I got my Morris application in.
Hurrah! College.
Hurrah. I still have to fill out the entire transcript.
Yay. I thought that the Morris made it easy to do the transcript.
No,
thing.
They don't at all.
Well, I thought they said that in the thing.
They lied.
This is interesting.
No, it took me 3 hours to fill in 2 years.
Well, it's supposed to take a long time. That's like the point. That's how they get you.
But I don't want it to take a long time. They're going to look at my transcripts anyways.
Yeah, it's the first part of the gauntlet, though. They want to make sure you're serious. If it was just something you could push a button and do, everyone would do it. This is the first test of an infinite number as you approach adulthood. And then every morning you wake up and you go, another test.
I mean, it is third on my list. So like, and I have a good chance of getting into the other two colleges on the front of my list.
Yes, but that's why you have safety schools, because nothing in this life is guaranteed. Guess what?
Except for death.
It's Halloween.
Woo.
But this episode won't come out before Halloween because of the way this is all falling down.
When will it come out?
After Halloween.
We could release it Halloween Wednesday.
I would have to like edit it like a full week early.
Do it.
Don't get right on it. Chances are very good this is coming out after Halloween, but it is not Halloween yet in real life. So happy Halloween.
Ooh.
Our last movie was Godzilla. It was not very scary.
Mm-mm.
So it's appropriate that we're watching a movie that is supposed to be a little scarier.
Spoopy.
A little scarier. I'm going to list a few names for you, though, and I want you... This is a little game. A little game we're going to play. Going to list a few names, and I want you to tell me what you think of when you hear those names. Like, what these people make you think of. All right, you ready? Here we go.
Do I know these people?
Robert Mitchum. What does that name make you think of?
Birds.
Shelley Winters.
Winter.
Peter Graves.
Sad.
Charles Lawton.
I recognize that.
Aha! Good, that's the test. Do you recognize the name Charles Lawton? We watched a movie starring Mr. Lawton that we both really liked, and it surprised us very much.
Was it The Raven?
No. He played a sort of monster man.
Black Lagoon?
Nope, he was creepy. They tried to make him sympathetic, but he was still creepy. He wore a lot of makeup.
Is it Frankenstein? No.
Nope.
Was it the thing from another world?
Nope. He ran around in the alleys and grabbed women. He lived in a giant church with bells.
Oh, the mimic.
No. He didn't live in a giant church.
Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yay, the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Yes, Charles Lawton played the Hunchback of Notre Dame, very famous
actor.
We've
watched a lot of movies where there's a guy wearing a lot of makeup and they try and make him sympathetic and it doesn't work.
What we are about to watch tonight, though, is not a movie that has Charles Lawton in it.
Then why did you say his name?
Why did I say his name? Because the movie we're going to watch tonight is directed by Charles Lawton.
Okay.
It is also the only movie ever directed by Charles Lawton.
Mm-hmm.
He never directed another film.
He just hated it so much.
And some people consider this movie to be one of the greatest American films ever made.
I've heard that about a lot of movies.
So hold on to your butts. All of them.
All six.
As we dive into 1955's The Night of the Hunter. Based on the novel, The Night of the Hunter.
Cool.
I'm not going to say anything else about it, but I just thought it was cool that it was directed by Charles Lawton, and we only know him on this show as an actor.
From The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
This movie is only an hour and a half long.
Only, you say.
There's a making of movie, though, that you can see in the DVD that is 2.5 hours long. So
the making of the movie is longer than the movie.
There's a lot of thoughts about this movie that go into the world. A lot of thinking thoughts. So are you ready to watch The Night of the Hunter?
Yes.
All right. Oh, hello, everyone. I'm Phil.
And I'm Ollie. Why did you do it in the middle of me yawning?
I didn't know you were yawning. I mean, I guess I was looking right at you. And it's Delta.
Let's do that again.
Hey, everybody, I'm Phil.
And I'm Ollie.
And it's Del Toro time. It's Del Toro time, and it's Halloween. Wait.
We're not starting the episode yet.
Let's go watch this.
Yeah. feels like it was a lot longer ago than it does.
Feel like a lot longer ago. Because every day is like a year in child life, child times. Oh boy, did we just watch a movie. And guess what?
What?
It is Halloween. I was waiting for you to jump in. It is.
I didn't know what kind of song you wanted me to sing.
Halloween. Happy Halloween, everybody. you can make up something too. Skeleton.
The only thing I can think of right now is Halloweeny.
Halloweeny.
Because of the what was the party?
The Weenie Witch party.
The Weenie Witch
skinless
party.
Skinless wieners. Mm-hmm. If you Google skinless wieners.
Don't
and
do that.
Weenie Witch party. Just Google skinless wieners Weenie Witch party, and that's and you will don't just Google skinless wieners. Google skinless wieners Weenie Witch party. Because you'll get this old ad for a thing you can do with hot dogs. And it says, like, bring your skinless wieners to your next Weenie Witch party. And I'm like, A Weenie Witch party is not a thing. B, if you brought skinless wieners to anyone and said, here's the skinless wiener, they would, like, not come to your party. So that's the truth. We just watched.
What is it called?
The Night of the Hunter. Very good.
I was gonna say The Haunting of Hill House. But
The Haunting of Hill Hunter.
The Hilting of Han Hunter.
We watched 1955's The Night of the Hunter, and what an experience!
Oh yeah.
Before we go into any details or any background or anything, I just want to know, like, what is your initial impression of The Night of the Hunter? Like, what'd you think of it?
Good.
Good? But, like, in what way? Like,
it was well done.
Was it what you expected at all? Like,
Kind of.
Because I had said, all I had told you was that it was, like, a psychological thriller.
Yeah, I mean, I think I knew that it was about a serial killer.
Yeah.
Because I can't remember. I think you told me it was based off of a real person.
Based on a book that's based on a real person.
Or maybe that was after we watched it. I can't remember. But I knew that it was about a serial killer.
But what about the style? Like the weirdness level of it?
I wasn't expecting that.
It is a jarringly strange film.
Yes.
If you're expecting a noir, it is not a noir picture. It has elements of noir, but also it's closer to like Tim Burton at times than it is to like Sam Spade. What did you think of the actors?
I liked all of them except for one.
Oh, which one did you not like?
The small little girl.
The small girl, but she had such a beautiful singing voice.
That was so weird. Suddenly, she's 40 years old.
There was a pretty fly. The song Pretty Fly was actually written for this movie. I did not know that. The little girl was supposed to sing that part. She had actually won a singing competition before she was cast in this movie. That's like how she got like kind of a name out there. But it was, the sound of the river was too loud, so they were going to have to record over her anyway, and her voice was too warbly, and they just ended up, like you just said, like having like a 40-year-old woman sing, like a professional sing. It was really strange, like, because I was like, is she supposed to be singing Pretty Fly? Because she's like 5. But she's obviously mouthing the words, so... How did Night of the Hunter get made? I'm going to try to do this like really quick making of. There is so much. If you want to know how Night of the Hunter got made, there are books. There are documentaries. There are commentary tracks. Get the Criterion 2-disc edition and you will be set for life on how did Night of the Hunter get made.
Isn't the making of on the Criterion edition longer than the actual movie?
There is a making of on it. There are interviews on it about the making of. There is a commentary track about the making of, but there you're thinking of the thing I mentioned, which is the 2.5-hour long documentary, which is called Charles Laughton Directs Night of the Hunter. It is amazing. It is all archival footage that people did not know existed for decades. That is just behind the scenes of its alternate takes. It's extended scenes. It's people in long takes, like doing their part and Charles Laughton reading. It's him giving direction. It's, and it walks you through the whole movie. So highly recommend, if you would like Night of the Hunter, pick up the Criterion Edition, go to your library and get it, however you want to get it. Watch Charles Laughton directs Night of the Hunter.
With all this repping we're doing for Criterion, they should really sponsor us, man.
They really should. Unfortunately, they're not doing so hot. Filmstruck just recently got shut down, and that was People's Source for Criterion movies online. So they're going to have to find another streaming home sometime soon, because, wow, they just got cut off at the knees there. Come to find out, streaming indie films isn't the money-making bankroll that the studios seem to think it was going to be. I don't know why. It's a pretty niche market, but yeah, RIP Filmstruck.
I didn't even know that place existed.
Yeah, it was basically the one place you could go to stream like a lot of indie films, but mostly people went to it for Criterion. They had a huge Criterion library. Speaking of library, public libraries also have Criterion. Check them out. That's where I got this. Because I don't have enough money to buy all these movies. So, Charles Laughton, we talked about him last time. Mr. Sanctuary!
Skinny... What?
Dong, Sanctuary!
Oh.
I'm up on the... In the bell tower!
Hunchback.
Hunchback. but that was a long time ago we watched that.
Yes.
And one of the Twitter shows was called The Old Dark House. That had Charles Laughton in it as well. Check it out. It's one of my little tiny episodes. Because I was like, I know we talked about him. Oh, that was just me talking about him to myself. a very funny role. He played a very comedic character. Charles Laughton was a big movie star. By the 1950s, he started having health problems. And his career was kind of like in a weird place. I believe it was Paul Gregory heard him do a reading of like a biblical reading or something. It was like, dang, this guy's got like a voice, like a killer voice. We should have you do readings just so you can make a mint just going around the country, like just doing readings. And he did. And that sort of like got him back. He had already done theater. He was a theater person, but that got him kind of back up on stage. Mm-hmm. And then it got him directing on stage again. And he directed for Broadway. And people were like, dang, Charles Laughton, he can also direct really well. And that was when the studios were like, let's see if he can handle a movie. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you think he'll like? And lo and behold, the book Night of the Hunter by Davis Grubb came out, and they were like, you know what Charles Laughton really likes? He likes Americana. He likes darkness at the heart of Americana. He loves religious hypocrisy and like exposing religious hypocrisy, but he's also really religious. So this is kind of the perfect book for him. And he read it and he loved it. And they were like, well, who should we get to write it? And they were like, well, you know who's like really kind of well known for writing about the dark heart of America is James Agee. So let's get him to write the screenplay. And James Agee wrote this like 240-page like phone book of a screenplay. Charles Laughton was like, I love it, but I'm going to have to cut it down. And what's really awesome about this movie was that Laughton and Agee and but especially Davis Grubb, who wrote the novel, they worked together. Like he was like, you know, you're the novelist, like I need you to work with me on this. And Davis Grubb was like, well, you know, I was an artist as well. Like, so I drew pictures of how I think these scenes look. And Laughton's like, give them to me. And a lot, if you look at these drawings he did, Laughton was like, well, just film it. Film it that way. Like, it just looks just like he just took it and used those as like a guy. So the author of the book had a big hand in how this movie, it was a real collaborative piece. Here's a funny thing. Do you know who else is one of our favorite actors is tied into this that you did not know?
Who?
Elsa Lanchester. Do you remember her?
No.
I'll give you a hint. I'll give you another one of my famous hints.
Your charades.
Here's the charades. Listeners at home, enjoy.
Cat woman?
Who is she? Who is she? I'll do another hint. Mary Shelley, how did you write such wonderful books? Oh, as a woman.
She was Mary Shelley.
She played the Bride of Frankenstein. Beautiful Mary Shelley, who we all thought was so wonderful. He was married to Elsa Lanchester for like decades. And it was right before this period in his career when he finally came out as, some say homosexual, some say bisexual, and started just basically just indulging his like long repressed sexuality. And Elsa Lanchester was like, that's cool, I love you, we're in love, and this is a part of your life you've always had to hide, and you're like you're in middle age now, it's about time you enjoyed something you've never enjoyed. So he was like known for like just stepping out with all these dudes. But she was totally supportive of that. She was like, we are a real, like, we are a loving couple. And they stayed married until the day he died. But yeah, he was known for his, like, sort of like, I'm an older guy and I'm finally just like, love me or leave me, world. And I just love that about him. I think that that's like, but they say that Night of the Hunter is an exploration of the dangers of repressed sexuality, which is a little, well, comes into play with our main character and a lot of the things that happen. So that's a little bit of background. He was, you know, he had to find a lead actor. We'll talk about him when we get to it, but that's kind of how it just got to be made. It was this hugely collaborative process. It was apparently just a wonderful experience for most everyone involved. He loved artists. He loved working with actors and like using like their input to create these characters in this world. He wasn't able to shoot on location, so he had to create this sort of like film all in the studio, so everything was very stagey, and he used that to his advantage. Just amazing.
You say he loved working with his actors.
Well, that's something we'll get to. That's something we'll get to. One last thing. Walter Schumann, who did the music, was said to be, I think it may have been Lawton, who either Lawton or Paul Gregory, the producer, who was like, yeah, Schumann was as instrumental, no pun intended, as the screenwriter in shaping this movie. They're like, because Lawton was like, this movie is good, like the music is just as, so you write songs for me, like, write choral pieces, like you, this is as an important part of this story. Like everything was like just vital to how this, and that's why it sort of ticks along so well. And also all this unusualness is also why it failed miserably in the movies and Charles Lawton never directed again, because
it was as it goes.
He was also in a lot of pain filming this. Come to find out he had cancer and did not know it. He died of cancer in the 60s, in the early 60s. But he went on. He had a career after this. He acted. But he was never – this wasn't his break into directing that he wanted it to be. If people hadn't been so stupid back then, we may have gotten a few more great Charles Lawton films after this. But let's
– You know who else really loves collaboration on their movies?
Tell me.
Del Toro.
Oh, really? Does he? In what way?
Always.
It's funny. I hadn't even thought of that. That's true. Like, this is very much a Del Toro approach to to filmmaking. What was the one that we talked about that a lot?
I can't remember.
I think it was Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
If you read any of his making of books, like the way he just brings in these amazing artists to help shape these worlds. I had not thought about that. Also, they're both big guys.
Great.
It was big guys.
I don't think Del Toro is hiding any repressed sexuality, though.
He may not be, but maybe he loves monsters.
I don't think he's hiding that very well, then.
Oh, that's true. Guillermo Del Toro's repressed love of monsters. Never would have guessed. But we do not love this monster. Why don't you tell us a little bit about... Well, why don't you tell us exactly about... What Night of the Hunter is about?
All right, so where do you want me to start?
Just begin with the beginning. What happens?
A man is running.
Okay, let's like...
Oh, wait, no, there's another part. There's another part. There's... Ooh, what is it? There's like a group of boys.
A group of boys.
Who? Are running around outside and playing. And then one of them playing hide and seek.
Okay. Oh, all right.
And then one of them goes into a barn and finds a body of a woman.
Yeah. And it's like a cellar door.
Mm-hmm. And he's like, huh, hey guys, come look at this. And they're all like, cool. And then they run off.
It's this crazy like helicopter shot too. It's like from above. Like, I was not expecting like sky footage.
Although that's not exactly where this starts.
Where does it exactly start? This is what I thought you were going
floating,
to.
Floating faces.
Floating faces?
Yep.
Of?
Women.
No.
And children.
Children. A woman.
Yes. Who was reading the Bible.
Yes. And you get this like old woman's face surrounded by little kids' faces, and she's reading to them about the Bible, and they're kind of talking about it. It's beware of false prophets.
Yeah.
And that's from Egge's screenplay. It's like Egge's screenplay was supposed to end with that, and Lawton was like, start with it. Like, Because the old woman comes into play much mm-hmm. later in the film. Like,
yes.
We see her, and then we're like, who are you? Mm-hmm. Some people said it actually caused confusion because people thought she may have been the victim that you saw at the beginning because she's, like, floating in the sky, and there's, like, Bible stuff, and then you see this dead body. So people were like, is that the woman he killed? But in any case. So tell us.
I would not have thought that at all, but okay.
Neither did I, but I was like, I can see where someone might think that. But, yeah, like, this cool, like, helicopter shot with these little kids, like, and they all, like, they're playing hide and seek.
So then there's a cutscene. And it goes to a man running, and then he's like, son, to his son, hide this money, or I'm going to hide this money, and you can't tell anyone where it is. Also, your little sister, she can't tell anyone where it is either. You got to swear to me. And then he gets arrested, and the kid is traumatized forever.
So this is our father figure, and this mm-hmm. is two children. Mm-hmm. Father played by, if you don't know, Peter Graves. I'm Peter Graves, and you know where Peter Graves went to school?
Where?
University of Minnesota. I'm Peter Graves, and I went to the University of Minnesota.
Which one?
I believe Twin Cities. There's a classic Mystery Science Theater 3000 sketch. It's called Peter Graves enrolls at the University of Minnesota. It's great. I think it's very funny. I'm Peter Graves. Peter Graves is a very famous actor. He went on to quite a career. This is like early in his career. We don't see much of him, but we'll talk about that later. So what did Peter Graves do that was so bad?
Robbed a bank?
I think he robbed
and
a bank.
And killed two people?
Mm-hmm. In the robbery. Mm-hmm. But is Peter Graves necessary? Okay, obviously he killed two people. But is he positioned as like a bad guy?
Not really.
And why?
Because it's the Great Depression.
And why did he steal the money?
Because he needed to feed his kids.
Right. So we're already set up with this like weird morality in mm-hmm. this movie. Like people who are villainous aren't necessarily the villains. This is a desperate world.
A sympathetic bad guy.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't stay a sympathetic bad guy for long. He becomes a sympathetic dead guy. Well, he does.
Yeah.
Because he is found guilty and.
Well, then there's the car scene with the preacher where he's talking to himself,
mm-hmm.
talking to God, I should say.
Yeah, so who is this preacher man?
What is his name?
We can just call him the preacher. He calls himself Harry Powell, but in the script and in the credits, he's actually simply listed as preacher.
So preacher uh-huh. is just in his car, just
rambling to himself.
Yep, about... I can't even remember.
He's like, how many women is it, Lord? 6? No, 12?
He's also talking about how the Lord gives him everything he needs when he needs it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's stopping in a town.
He goes to see a...
Oh, yeah. That weird
burlesque
thing.
Show.
Yeah. And there's the hate fist.
And he has... What does he carry in his pocket?
A knife.
And what happens when he gets really excited at the wah-wah-wah-wah-wah show?
He pulls out his knife.
Well, he doesn't pull it out. It comes shooting out of his pocket.
That's symbolism for
it. It was supposed to be his pants pocket, by the by, but Lawton was like, we're never going to be able to get away with that. So he changed it to the coat pocket because he was like, they're going to cut that.
Yeah. I wonder what that's supposed to symbolize. Anyways, and then he gets arrested for stealing a car.
For stealing the very car that he was like driving around in.
And they're like, but I'm a reverend, so blah 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 blah. And they're like, what the hell are you doing here?
Yeah. So what happens in prison though?
He's put in the same room as Dad.
Mm-hmm.
As Dad guy. And Dad guy whispers in his sleep about the money. And
it's
then,
convenient.
What?
It's convenient. Mm-hmm. Convenient. Sleep talking.
And then preacher's like, what money? And tries to get him to talk in his sleep about it. And then blah blah blah, long story short, dad guy gets executed, hasn't told anyone about the money, and reverend gets out after his 30 days.
Yep. And he hightails it to
the home,
the widow Harper.
What's her name? Willa?
What's her name? The widow Willa. Willa the widow.
Just say widow.
The widow, Willa. So our main characters are this reverend, Willa, and then her two kids, John and...
Annoying.
John and...
Pearl. I'm Pearl. Hello, I'm Pearl.
John and Pearl. But what does Pearl look like?
A Cabbage Patch doll.
Yeah, she looks like... She looks like... a cartoon.
She looks like Lucy.
Yeah, she has this weird face.
Like Lucy mixed with Charlie Brown's sister.
And I'm not throwing shade on like a child for having a weird face. Most children have weird faces. That's the way faces work. But she's unearthly. Like, she's strange looking. Lawton did say, this is what you were bringing up. Lawton did say that, like, he found her, like, a detestable child. Apparently, like, didn't enjoy working with her. But it was those qualities that he liked about her. That's why he thought she was perfect for the role, because she was, like, just unpleasant. She was just this unpleasant kid. And she's 5 years old. Like, and you watch her being directed, and she is actually quite adorable while she's being directed, because she's trying really hard. She's 5 years old. Like, this British gentleman is like giving her direction, like, no, try it again. He's very gruff. Like, he's friendly, but he's like a gruff director. Like, come on, we have, just do it again, try it this way. So you watch her, this little girl whose name is Sally Jane Bruce, who never acted again after this, I don't believe, and John, her brother, played by Billy Chapin, who was an experienced actor. And you watch him taking direction, and he's just like, yep. He's giving you different takes each time. He's trying different things. He went on to have not a career after this much either, and then he, like, had a lot of health problems and stuff. Poor Billy Chapin. The preacher, by the way, played by Robert Mitchum. He was not the first choice for the role.
You're switching topics all of a sudden.
Sorry, I just want to cover who's playing whom. Robert Mitchum, people know who Robert Mitchum is. He was in two movies this year, two big movies, and it was the other movie that was actually successful. So that was sad, because no one remembers the other movie. And then Shelley Winters plays the mom. Shelley Winters had been kind of the blonde bombshell early in her career, and then she like was like, I don't like that. I want to be a real actor. So she then real actored for a long time, and this is kind of the second phase of the Shelley Winters career, where she's not playing like sexy young fangs anymore. She's playing like women approaching middle age, who are a little like.
Frazzled
is a good word for it. She played the mom in Stanley Kubrick's Lolita, and kind of a very similar role to this. Guy comes into her life, has designs on the kid, and she's just kind of like, what's going on? And then, of course, in her later years, she went on to play a lot of like just tough as nails women. I would not have wanted to run into Shelley Winters in a dark alley. I'll just put it that way. She could beat my butt into the dirt. I would be so afraid of upsetting Shelley Winters.
I think a lot of people could.
Yeah. But mostly Shelley Winters. There's this story that my acting teacher told me in college about Shelley Winters. This is like supposed to be like, this is how amazing an actor she was. And I don't know if this is true. This is probably the most apocryphal story. It's probably been told about a million actors. So this is just, but this is a story I was told, which was that Shelley Winters was in an acting class, and they had this acting exercise. So they had to get up in front of the class and do an activity that they did every day. They had to act an activity that they do every day, which is a very common acting exercise. Get up and act it out. And my teacher was all, Shelley Winters got up there, and she dropped her pants, and she pooped right in front of the class. And we were like, yeah, that's like amazing. And like looking back on it years later, I'm like, that probably wasn't true. Why would she have done that? It doesn't even prove anything. It sounded awesome to a bunch of college students. We were just like, we were like, are we supposed to, like, I don't want to do that in front of the class. I don't think I could. Second, like, did she pull her pants back up afterwards? Because that was like, because then you're like kind of a mess. I don't think she actually pooped on in class. I would have also like been kicked. She would have been kicked out of class.
She would have been kicked out of school.
Like, this is acting class, not pooping class, Shelley Winters. So if anyone listening can, like, yay or nay, the Shelley Winters pooped on stage story, or pooped in class, not even on stage. I definitely don't think I could do that on stage. Like, if a role called for it, nope. I'd just be like, sorry, guys, I'm all dried up. Anyway.
Back to the children.
Yeah, preacher shows up.
No, that's not even, you never finished your story about the little girl.
What about her?
And the takes.
Oh, she's good. She's fine. Charles Lawton, she was annoying to him, but he actually like thought she was perfect for the role. Anyway, back to the story. So Charles, preacher man shows up.
And is like, hello.
Uh-huh.
And John's like, no. And the mom's like, be respectful. And Pearl is like, I love you.
Yeah, immediately. Pearl's after her father. John is like, you are the embodiment of evil. And Willa is like, meow, meow.
Well, at first she's like, no.
Can we talk about the fact that there's a character in this movie who runs a soda ice cream store? Her name is
Icy Spoon.
Her name is Icy Spoon. Can we talk about how I can't get over the fact that there's a character named Icy Spoon?
Does it make any sense?
Why is her name Icy Spoon? Is it in the novel? Like, is it answered in the novel? Is there a whole chapter about why her?
She married a guy whose last name is Spoon.
Yeah.
So she adopted that last name.
Yes.
So, I mean, I'm assuming her parents didn't name her Icy Spoon.
No, I know that, but a man did. A man named Davis Grubb, who wrote the novel, was like, what's a good name for... I'm writing this book about murder in America. What is a good name for my ice cream store woman? Icy Spoon.
Yeah, but they're like kind of the comic relief of the story.
A little bit, but also her name is Icy Spoon. And that's what do you find in a soda shop, an ice cream store? Icy Spoons.
Why do you keep saying soda shop?
It's an ice cream store. It's basically a Baskin Robbins.
Yeah.
And that is where Willa works, by the way.
Who?
The mom, Willa.
I thought you said Willow for a second.
Nope. Don't know anyone with that name.
That's not true. You have other friends.
I don't have any friends. So
everyone who's listening to this just got really offended.
I don't have any friends. Willa, the mom, the mama, the widow, works at this ice cream. And also, everyone in town hates them because their father got hanged.
Yes.
All the kids hate them and make dirty pictures on the wall.
And sing songs.
And sing terrible songs about the dead father.
Which is...
So you get the idea. It's the middle of the Depression. The family doesn't have much money. The father was robbing a bank to get money.
Somehow they still have
money.
A really large house.
They still have a house, but... They're in dire straits. And then this preacher shows up, and he's very kind to everyone. The town loves him because he preaches, and he has these fists. Talk about his fists.
The love and hate fists.
Why are they called that?
That show, well, they're tattooed with love and hate on the knuckles.
Will you do his monologue? Please, as best as you can, please do the monologue.
I don't even know. I can't even remember it.
Please, just do it. This is an acting exercise. You can either do the monologue or poop on the stage.
I don't remember the monologue.
What is it? Let me tell you the story
sort of love and hate or something.
Yep.
The universe or something.
Uh-huh. And what do they do?
They fight.
How do they fight?
They just do.
Uh-huh. But he does it with his hands.
Yeah. He like...
And then what happens?
Sometimes love is falling.
Mm-hmm.
But then love gets back up and pushes hate down. But neither can ever win in this cosmic battle of love and hate.
See, you remember it. If you've ever seen Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee, there's a version of the same exact monologue by Radio Raheem in it. He has a love and hate, like basically, what are they called? On your
brass
face.
Knuckles.
Brass knuckles. One says love, one says hate. He does the monologue, except it's instead of being about wrestling, it's because he can't wrestle because he has the things on his fingers.
It's about punching
someone? About punching. And he's like, just this fight between love and hate. But he basically does the monologue. In character, in the context. It's a very amazing scene in Do the Right Thing. It's like borrowed, but he paid homage. Very well done. Love, hate. Also, I think it's creepy and a stupid monologue.
Yes.
It doesn't prove anything or teach anything, but the people in town love it.
And except for John. John's just like, what is happening? Why do you have hate tattooed on your hand?
It reminds me of like when like a mediocre like actor is like celebrated in their hometown for being the best actor because they're probably the best actor in the hometown. Like he's not a great preacher or speaker, but he's probably better than anyone else they have. Do they even have a church?
Yes.
Do they?
Yes.
How do you know?
I'm pretty sure they mentioned something about going to mass together.
Oh, that's right. They also have a boat with an old man in it. What is his name?
Yes, the old man is just in the boat.
He is just in the boat.
No, it's a boathouse.
What is his name?
Mr. Birdie. Uncle Birdie.
You remember this. You looked this up.
Yes.
Why did you look this one thing up?
Because I needed to know.
Know what?
If he was going to be okay.
He's not okay.
No. Uncle Birdie, he has his weirdest...
Is it Birdie or Bertie?
It's Birdie.
Okay.
I can't remember. He had the most ridiculous, like, other name, though.
I don't remember.
No, he didn't ever mention this other name.
Wait, then why do you say he had a ridiculous name? That's a very unfair thing to say to an
because
old man.
Because I looked it up.
An old man who's on the drink. His name is Uncle Birdie Steptoe.
Yes, that's what it is.
Well, Steptoe's a real name.
It is?
Yes. There was a famous TV series called Steptoe and Son in the UK. It was brought to America and called Sanford and Son. Ring any bells?
Yes. Steptoe's a dumb name.
Is a very name. And so Uncle Bertie is nobody's uncle, but he's friends with John, yes. The little boy. And he's like kind of the only person that John can confide in.
Because he's the only one that has any sense in the entire town.
You're right. But he's unfortunately also a man of great emotions and great drinking ability.
Great drink. But he also can fish a lot.
He does fish a lot. That'll come back to haunt him later on in this story.
He has a dead wife.
That's right. A picture of her.
Who he feels is watching him all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's strangely religious, just like everyone in this movie is.
Is he religious?
They're all strangely religious.
But I didn't think he was.
Here's something funny that I found out from the making of. The town, if you look at the town, like the way it's laid out, you're like, there's some strange things in the town, like a fence that just exists, but there's nothing behind it. And like signs to businesses that don't actually exist. They're just signs, mm-hmm. but like there's no business there. There's no door or anything. And if you watch the movie, and I really want to go back and watch it this way, the whole set is designed to be to appear as it would appear to a child who only notices certain things throughout the day. So he never notices the building behind the fence. So you never actually see the building behind the... Like, it's an incomplete town. And it's crazy when you know this and you look at it.
Are you sure that's not just their excuse for never completing the set?
No, it's totally true. Like, you look at the designs and you're like, oh, this is... It's a little nuts. There's a scene near the end where... In the final scenes where they're in the big city and there's, like, the young girl. And she's you see all the neon signs. And you're like, this doesn't make any sense. These neon signs are just on a wall for different businesses. And that's the same thing. Like, to a young girl... You're just noticing these signs. So the audience only gets to see the signs. It's kind of cool. So, man, we are crawling through this plot. we're only a little bit of waste. So let's just say, what happens to the fam? What happens? So why is he there? Like, where is his money?
The money's in the doll.
And does he ever find out about this?
Yes.
What happens to the mom?
She dies.
Before then, though.
She goes insane.
Before then, though, she...
Marries him.
really quick, like. People are pressuring her to get married.
Mm-hmm. Specifically, Icy.
Let's talk about their horrible wedding night.
No.
It's probably the saddest scene I've ever seen in my entire life on screen. Shelley Winters is all like, this handsome man, and we're married now. And he's just like, don't ever touch me. Like, he does the total psychopath, like 360 or 180 on her. Like, he's just in bed, and he's like, your body is disgusting. And you're like, oh, no. Oh, Shelley Winters, no. Oh, no. And he, like, basically just, like, strips her of her entire, like, self-worth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, right there in one scene. And you're like, oh, no. This guy's bad news.
Well, we already knew that.
We already knew he was bad news. But now he's, like, emotionally bad news. But she doesn't, like, leave him.
Nope.
She actually goes a little...
crazy.
Yep. Like, how so?
Like, religious crazy.
Yeah. Like, revival crazy. But also, like, she refuses to believe that he's looking for the money until she overhears him looking for the money.
Mm-hmm.
And
pressuring her small child to tell him.
Mm-hmm. So, what does he do to her?
Kills her.
When?
At night.
Where?
In her bed.
How?
With the pocket knife.
Does he stab her in the heart?
No.
No, what does he do?
Slits her throat.
From?
Left to right.
Ear to ear, so they say. Cuts her throat. Cuts it big. Cuts it wide. And you don't see it happen.
No.
No, they don't show it. But you see him, raise his knife up almost like a sac. Well, it intentionally looks like a sacrificial sacrifice. And, but then, what does he do with her body?
Throws it.
Well, he puts it in the
car.
And puts it in the...
lake. River.
River, yeah. And who finds it?
Bertie.
How?
When he's fishing, because he fishes up a part of the dress.
And do you see her under the water?
Yes.
And what does she look like?
Dead.
I wasn't expecting that shot when they showed it. It is one of the most... hauntingly beautiful, but also like pretty graphic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you see this dead woman in a car.
You see her neck.
Yeah, like, throat slit. She's dead in the car, and she's underwater, and her hair is blowing, like, billowing behind her. Mm-hmm. And you see fish, and it's terrifying.
Yep.
And unfortunately, so Birdie sees it because it's only like
2 feet underwater. It's a shallow lake.
It's crystal clear. Crystal, mm-hmm. like he just looks down. He's like, whoop, whoop. But he doesn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because what does he think?
The cops are going to blame him.
Which makes
no sense.
But
is character emotions.
So what does he do instead?
Drinks.
How much?
A lot.
All of it.
All of the drink.
He drinks all of the booze in the county and is useless for the rest of the movie. Unfortunately, that's his tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Although the cops did eventually find her body, so I'm going to go with the fact that eventually after he sobered up, he told them.
Yes. And then he got married to a beautiful woman.
No.
Mm-hmm. And she was rich, and they opened a bigger houseboat.
A bigger houseboat?
And they live happily ever after. The story of Birdie. He's done. He's happy. There's a terrifying scene in the basement.
Oh, yeah.
That's like something out of like Halloween. And the kids are stalked by him, by the Reverend. And he tries to get them. But they escape. And where do they go?
The river.
What does he do when he can't catch them in the water? Do you remember this?
No.
Do you remember what he does? He's chasing them, and they're running from him, and they get in the boat, and he's going through he's having trouble getting through like the shallow water.
Mm-hmm.
And they manage to get off in the boat ahead of him, and he stops, and he makes this sound.
Oh yeah.
Like a wounded animal. It's like, I was not expecting this noise to come out of his mouth. Like, I was like, I have seen a lot of acting in my day. I have seen a lot of great performances in my day. I did not know that Robert Mitchum could sound like a crazy dog. Because he's just like, and I was like, no. And this begins the next phase. Like, suddenly the movie just shifts.
Mm-hmm.
And we are in, like, Alice in Wonderland all of a sudden.
Yep.
We are like giant animals on the riverbank, like giant frog, giant spider web, little girl singing a song about a pretty fly. And they are going down this endless river, and he is stalking them down the river.
On a horse.
Uh-huh. And they keep trying to find places to stop, and he is always there, like this relentless pursuit by this dude who's always right behind them. They keep having to like get up in the middle of the night, head on. I can't describe this scene. It is like a nightmare and a dream.
Mm-hmm.
It's so strange. And but they eventually land. How do they get found by Lily and Gish?
Well, first they land at a farmhouse and they sleep in the rafters.
Right.
And then they see him. They go down, get back in the boat, and they start boating back.
Oh, right.
Because he passes them by.
Yeah.
And they fall asleep in the boat, and then they wash up on a bank where she is.
Yeah. And if you're watching this movie and you're like, this is like a fairy tale or something, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. It mm-hmm. is intentionally like we're watching a children's fairy tale, a scary, scary fairy tale. So they wash up and they're found by Lillian Gish. And Lillian Gish, just as way of explanation, Charles Laughton was totally inspired by the movies of D.W. Griffith. Now, we know that D.W. Griffith was a terrible racist, and he's almost single-handedly responsible for bringing the Ku Klux Klan back to the United States from his movie Birth of a Nation and also his movie The Klansman. Besides that, though, he was also a film pioneer. He created a lot of amazing ways of using the camera, a lot of ways of telling a story with film. So let's not forgive him for his many, 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 many horrible sins, but also remember that people looked at him as a filmmaker. And one of his stars was this silent film actress named Lillian Gish. Just a knockout beauty, just a beautiful young woman. Super famous, but she had kind of retired by this point. Mm-hmm. The talkies were here. She wasn't a big name, but people remembered her as being D.W. Griffith's star. Charles Laughton loved D.W. Griffith's movies. He screened them for people in preparation for this movie, because he's like, I want my movies to look like this, like with like the fuzzy outline around the edges of the screen, with the iris closing in some mm-hmm. scenes to show act breaks, and just the way there's he wanted his movie to look like a silent film. He wanted to bring silent film back, like just that style. And when he was screening these movies at like I don't remember like one of the museums, maybe in New York, and Lillian Gish caught wind of this. It was mm-hmm. like, why is someone watching all these old Lillian Gish movies? Like, Charles Laughton, the actor? Why is he doing this? And they're like, oh, he's directing a film. She was like, oh, that's interesting. So he's looking for someone to play this role. And they went through a bunch of different names. And someone was like, why not Lillian Gish? Like, you're trying to get a Lillian Gish type. He kept saying that. Like, I want a Lillian Gish type. And he's like, what? And they're like, why don't you just get Lillian Gish? And he's like, there's absolutely no way. She's retired. She doesn't act anymore. There's no way she would do this movie. And they were like, give it a shot. So they go to, he sets up a meeting with her, brings her the screenplay, tells her about the movie. And she's like, I'm totally on board for this. I totally want to play this role. And she did. And she is amazing.
Yep.
And please tell us about this amazing role.
This lovely woman. I don't want to say old because she's not that old.
She's not that old.
She's like.
She's a middle age.
She's like late middle age.
Yeah.
Is caring for all these kids mm-hmm. in the Great Depression. These kids who don't have homes or families because she lost her son.
Her family doesn't speak to her anymore. Yeah. It's kind of like the sense you get. Like, yeah, she hasn't heard from them, her children.
Weird.
Yeah.
In my opinion. But whatever, ungrateful kids. But so she raises all these kids. She finds the two in a boat and is like, get in the house. And they're like, no. And she's like, get in the house.
She takes a switch and starts like driving them forward like you would drive like geese.
And then they meet these other three girls who are picking fruit, apples,
mm-hmm.
something.
Yeah, they're picking something.
They get a bath.
They do get a bath. They
John is like, no.
Mm-hmm. And he gets spanked again. Gets spanked. I was like, oh, Lillian Gish, these kids have been through hell. Maybe you don't like... beat them, please. But I guess it was a depression, and she was Lillian Gish. And she has like, so she has these three girls, and one of them is named Ruby.
Mm-hmm. We don't learn the other ones' names, do we?
Yeah, they're just kind of around.
Yeah,
they have lines, like they're there, but mm-hmm. Ruby is the oldest, and she's like the main girl. So yeah, she brings in these stray children, and she feeds them, and she dresses them well, and she educates them, and she reads them Bible stories, and she's basically like. If she doesn't read them Bible stories, she tells them mm-hmm. Bible stories. And she makes them, like, relatable to the kids. She tells the story of Moses, and she tells the story of Jesus as mm-hmm. a baby. Like, when Herod, like, called for the death of all the children and the family ran away. And you're like, oh, I get it. Like the baby in the bulrushes and them washing up on shore. It's a lot of biblical like parallels here.
And it's also just, she's kind of the other side of the coin from the preacher.
Yes. Charles Laughton did not trust churches, but he not just religion, but he was very religious. He just saw the hypocrisy of the church as mm-hmm. like a stain on society, but he was deeply religious. And this was kind of his way of showing like, here's the preacher who's like the hypocrisy of the repressed sex, of the violence, of the using like an oil tongue to like get what you want part of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And then here is Lillian Gish, who is like just trying to be a good person mm-hmm. and also teach lessons and also like tell Bible stories and stuff. Like she's not some like humanist. She's not like a nature goddess. Mm-hmm. She's religious. But it's kind of like becomes like sort of the battle between like faith and religion. Yeah.
Battle of the sexes.
It literally becomes a battle.
It.
So what does Lillian the Gish do?
She is like, so what's your story? Our parents are dead. Cool. moving on.
What happens with Ruby?
I can't really tell. She's like getting all these sugar daddies, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Ruby is telling Rachel. That's Lillian Gish's character's name. Ruby keeps telling, and Ruby's how old? Like 13? Would you say like 13, 14? Yeah. She says like, I'm going out to some class or some.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a sewing class, something like that, like some like little thing. But what she's actually doing, she's going into the city and hooking up with men. who buy her things.
Yeah, but I don't think, like, does she have sex with them?
You don't really know. I think the implication is that she does, is that she's kind of like, she has, like, given her, like, mm-hmm. sexuality to these men to get what she wants, get affection, basically. And unfortunately, she runs into
Preacher Man.
The Preacher Man, who gets information out of her, basically.
Mm-hmm. By buying her an ice cream.
He does buy her an ice cream.
And a comic book.
That's right. Yeah. So this is the part of the movie that, like, I was having trouble, like, not crying during, because you see this in watching it. You're watching this little girl who's, like, trying to be older than she is, whose affections are being bought by these, like, men, but who are buying her affections with comics and candy. Like, she's a little kid. And it just broke my heart. And I'm glad it was addressed. It gets addressed in the movie. And I'm just like, whew, like, really well. In, like, my favorite moment of the film. But in any case, he gets the info from... Because I guess he knows the kids are around.
Yeah. I assume, like, since they didn't show back up at the other town, he's like, well, they weren't... I didn't see any signs of them further along the river, so they must have gone back. So they aren't back home, so they must be... in this sort of in-between place.
Right. And so he shows up at the house and demands them.
And Rachel's like, sure. And Pearl brings the kids out. Pearl runs up to him and is like, I love you, Dad. And I'm like, shut up. And then Rachel goes to John and says, your father's here. And he goes, that ain't my dad.
Yeah.
He gives a little smirk.
That's right. That's right. And the preacher tries to win Rachel over with his hand show, with his hand wrestling.
And I can't remember what she says to it, but it was really sassy and awesome.
It was sassy and awesome. He starts doing the hate and love story, which you as an audience member know is BS, but you're kind of like, I guess maybe it's supposed to be awesome because everyone seems to think it's awesome. But then you watch Rachel's face the whole time and you're like, oh, no, this is stupid. Like, this is really dumb. And she knows it's dumb. And she's like, uh-huh. Great, get off my land. You're not having these kids. And so he starts waiting them out.
And she has a gun.
Yep. He just sits on a stump and stares at the house.
Because he brought out his knife.
Yeah.
And tried to threaten her with it. And she was just like, nope.
Kaboom. He actually chases John at one point under the house or something.
And then that's when... He dives into the house. That's when she gets the gun and just is like, can I help you?
Right. And then it becomes this, like, just a sort of, like, waiting game. He's out there. She's in there. How do they end up clearing it all up?
She gets distracted by Ruby, who's in love with the preacher.
Right. So Ruby's fallen for the preacher's wiles as well. And this is where the scene comes in, where Ruby admits what she's been doing. Mm-hmm. And you expect Rachel to be, like, stern or, like, disappointed in her. But instead, she's like, oh. She's like, you're a kid and you just wanted love. And you went after it the only way you knew how. And you don't have to get love that way. We love you here. Like, you didn't do anything wrong. And she, like, hugs her. And I was like, tears. I am dying inside. Like, this wonderfully, like, accepting woman. But also, so she's distracted by Ruby, and then what happens?
The man disappears.
He just...
Yeah, because remember, he was sitting on the stump out there, and then she turns away for a second, and he's gone.
Yep, he floats away.
Like a ghost.
And in the end...
No. She goes inside and has all the kids with her. She sees him, and he comes at her with the knife, and then she shoots him, and he makes that noise again. And runs into the barn.
Yeah.
And she calls the police.
Yep.
And the police are like, why didn't you call us before? And she's like, don't worry about it. And so they have to wait until morning for the police to get there. But the police get there and they're like, yeah, this guy is, we've connected him to all these murders and blah, 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 blah. So they arrest him. And then traumatized John relives his dad's arrest.
Yep.
And starts screaming at them. And then starts beating the man, the preacher, over the head with the doll that has all the money in it, and the money goes flying everywhere. And then he passes out.
Yeah. Does he wake up?
No, he's dead. Yeah, he wakes up. He wakes up.
And then what happens?
Christmas time. Sudden tonal shift.
Yep. It's Christmas, and John gets a watch.
Oh, wait, we have to go through the trial first.
Oh, that's right. There's like a whole like...
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of other characters and stuff. But yeah, he gets sentenced to death.
Mm-hmm.
And a lynch mob forms of the townspeople who were so keen on him before, but all of a sudden now he's the worst thing in the world. They want to lynch him. Again, this is all based on what really happened to the guy who this is loosely based on. They had to like sneak him out of the back of the jail just so they could execute him. There was a hangman in the beginning of the movie who had to hang the father.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, I hate this job. I hate having to do this. But in this one, he's like, looking forward to doing this one. Guy killed 13 women. And then what happened? Then it's Christmas morning and John gets a watch. And what else happens? He gives Rachel one of her own apples, but it's a symbolic gesture.
Because they shared an apple the night that they actually connected.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's happy. They all have money now because of all the money that...
Yep, they have the... How much money was it?
$2,000?
$10,000?
$10,000.
Yeah, it was like 10,000 bucks. Which, during the Great Depression... It's going to last you.
Forever.
It's literally going to last you forever. And you just assume that the kids are just there now. Like they just, Rachel owns them. She is their
owns
own.
Them?
Yeah, she is their warden. They're there. They're in there. And they're all a nice happy family.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has a somewhat satisfying ending, but it's still dark, dark, dark.
I like the ending.
Dark film. Yeah, it's really well put together. How many of slasher film tropes started with this movie?
A lot.
Here's something funny. That whole basement scene where he's chasing them and like he goes to chase them upstairs and he trips on something and he falls into the door and the door slams on his fingers and he's like, rah, 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 and he falls back down the stairs was originally supposed to be, was done that way. To mimic basically a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
It was way more cartoonish than the rest of the movie.
There are several moments where he is supposed to be a cartoon character. Like literally Lawton was like, you're a cartoon character in this scene. You're going to look at...
Because it's from the kid's perspective.
You're going to be this buffoonish monster. We're going for laughs here. And they were like, what are you doing? And they were just like, no, this is part of the, this is the weirdness of this movie. Like we're going back and forth from like wife murder to cartoon character.
Because kids have to process information.
Yeah, it's weird. Like the whole movie is very much seen through the eyes of like, the scene where Robert Mitchum kills Shelley Winters with the knife. Their whole bedroom looks like a cathedral, like the inside of a cathedral. But the set is just, it's a bed, like a nightstand. And a backdrop that looks like a roof.
And a mirror.
And a mirror. But there's no walls. Like, this was filmed on an empty stage. You don't see any walls or anything. And that's intentional. It's supposed to look like this weird, like, dream nightmare. Like, this, like, where are they? Like, they're in a void. And like, yeah, it's like this weird, it's a stage technique. Like, you're only seeing what you need to see in this scene. It's creepy. And it works.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Can we talk about the scene where John and has to trick... like lies about where the money is to get him to go into the basement. He says it's under the stone. And then they go on, they all go into the basement and the guy's like, this is cement. And John's like, yoink.
Wait, what is yoink?
Yoink is pulling down a drawer full of glass things onto his head.
That was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That was before the escape up the stairs. It's a scene because it combines like I said, it's like, it's your classic, the slasher has trapped you in the basement and is down in the basement with you scene, but also this weird slapstick.
It suddenly turned into Faithful Yours.
Yes. Like, like a stepped on a can. Oh no. Like once it's Home Alone. It becomes Home Alone like for like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And then you're back with like, these kids are about to get killed by a madman. Mm-hmm. Like, I like the reveal of the money in the doll. You see the little girl Pearl has taken the money out of the doll and is cutting it into paper dolls.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, no, like partly put the money away. He's right behind you. And second, don't cut up the money. It's the Great Depression.
I liked the symbolism, of, cause they put the money away, but the paper dolls don't get put away. It's a boy and a girl that she's cut out.
Uh-huh.
And the man steps out And the paper dolls are underneath the man, and they go behind him into the shadows. And I really liked that because I feel like it symbolized a lot of what happened in the movie.
It's like every frame of this movie symbolizes something. Mm-hmm. It's very strange. Like, if you haven't seen The Night of the Hunter, it is an uncommonly weird movie. I said Tim Burton earlier, but is very Tim Burton was, of course, in his early movies was very influenced by the German expressionist cinema, and this is very German expressionist. But also, when you get to like Rachel's farmland, it's very naturalistic. Like you go from like weird psycho like cartoony children's story to all of a sudden just extremely natural, a lot of details. That farmhouse is like abundant. There's like little things in every corner. It's like Lawton knew what he was doing. The designers knew what they were doing.
It's because like in like the part that's not Rachel's like farmhouse, the kids aren't paying attention to their surroundings as much as they would normally because they're running.
Yeah.
And they're scared. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they get to this sort of safe haven, their brains switch back on and they're taking a look at everything around them.
Right. So this movie came out and the studio did not know how to sell it. Like they literally had no clue how to sell it. The posters were like, it's a thriller, but it stops being a thriller for a long time, becomes this weird drama, this weird like fairy tale. They tried to sell it on like kind of like on Robert Mitchum's star power, but then he was a bad guy, so it was like, well, that's weird. Plus, he had another movie coming out. They didn't know what to do with it. So they like, I think Lawton wanted to take it on, like do the film tour to, like, drum up interest in it. But they were like, no, it's just not, we don't know what this movie is. Like, you made this weird movie. And even the critics were like, it's okay. It's weird. It wasn't even, like, a critical darling. And it disappeared for a long time. Like, it just disappeared, like, off the face of the earth. Like, no one talked about this movie. And it wasn't until the 70s, really, with, like, this resurgence in, like, weird, like, old Hollywood, like, forgotten Hollywood, that people were like, oh, Night of the Hunter is a really good movie. And then it got put on, like, it got reserved to, like, the Library of Congress. Like, it became this.
It's a shame he died before you could see that happen.
I know. That's one of the tragedies of Charles Lawton's life, is that he didn't realize that he's become one of the most celebrated American directors of all time for his one movie.
Mm-hmm.
He made one movie. I just think it's so sad.
Who knows? Maybe if heaven does exist, he's looking down and can see all of it.
Maybe it is. And I hope he's like, I was going to say something crude.
What are you going to say?
Never mind.
What are you going to say?
If heaven does exist, I hope he's like spending eternity in the company of a lot of like banging dudes that he never got to enjoy in life. And Elsa Lanchester.
And also his wife.
I hope she is also spending time in the company of a lot of banging dudes.
maybe they could be spending some time together as well.
And together, they have eternity. Who knows? I don't know anything about heaven. I'm no religious expert. So was this movie scary? Like,
yes.
Was it a scary movie?
Yes.
You think so?
Yes.
Some people are like, it wasn't intended to be a horror film, but now it's considered like a classic horror movie.
I don't know if, like, were you scared by it?
I wasn't, like...
Okay, here's my thing. It's very different if you're watching it from a female perspective.
Mm. How so?
Well, he's specifically targeting women.
Yeah.
And just the weird, like, it's very different. It's hard to explain. It's just, like, seeing this guy sort of schmoozing around, like, convincing everyone he's great.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just, it's a thing that a lot of women have to deal with after they get attacked or assaulted.
Yeah. It's a very misogynistic character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's for me, as a female person,
yeah,
it was terrifying.
Right. And they let Mitchum be very sexually threatening. Mm-hmm. For someone who is violently opposed to any kind of sexual contact, mm-hmm. like his character is anti-sex, he is still incredibly sexually threatening.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird line that they walk with it. but I think it makes him like, I don't know, he's so unpredictable and bizarre.
Yeah.
Like a prime sociopath. Just one of, I think one of cinema's great, great serial killers. The novel by David Scrubb, I just want to, the character he's based on was this guy, I'm trying to find his name. It was based on, so the character in the story is Harry Powell.
Mm-hmm.
That's the name of the preacher in the story. They call him Harry Powell, even though you get the feeling that's not his real name.
Mm-hmm.
He's based on the true story of Harry Powers. So not that, it's not that opaque. Who murdered two women, mm-hmm. two widows, and one of the women had three kids. He murdered all of her kids. And he buried the bodies. He was married, actually. He actually had a wife. And he would marry, he put in Lonely Hearts ads, and which was a thing people used to do. You'd fill out basically, hi, I'm looking for a partner. And you put it in the newspaper, and then you'd meet a partner, you get married. And then if that partner was a serial killer, you'd get killed by them. And then they'd bury you in their backyard, like Harry Powers did. And then he was caught.
Sounds very familiar to Henry Bowers.
M-O-O-N. That spells moon. Wait, that's a different Stephen King book. But there was a moon in that one, too. There's a moon. Henry Bowers sees the clown in the moon.
Listens. The moon talks to him.
Right. And then in the TV movie, the clown actually appears in the moon.
And then it says, we don't know what happens in
The new movie,
because that part hasn't come out
However,
yet.
The new movie is still directed by Andy Muschietti,
mm-hmm.
who directed
Mama.
So, again, connection. We're not off topic.
It's true.
Harry Powers was... Harry Powers was arrested and executed and... Then his story was, of course, very well known. And when David Scrubb wrote Night of the Hunter, he based it on that. And so it took place during the Depression. Like, he did this during the Depression. So it was all very, very relevant. But Guillermo del Toro really liked this movie. He put it on his big list. What are some aspects of this that make us think of
all of it?
The films of Guillermo del Toro.
All of it.
In what way?
This, the atmosphere, the characters, everything.
I would be interested in seeing a Guillermo del Toro take on this story. Mm-hmm. Even though I think that the best take on this story has probably been done.
This one.
Mm-hmm. Not the TV movie starring Richard Chamberlain that was made like in the 1970s or whatever, which I haven't seen. I'm sure it's fine, but I'm sure it's not this movie, which is just...
I'm sure it's not.
This movie is a cusp of weirdness. Like, it is just... This is a weird movie.
There's a lot of tonal shifts.
Mm-hmm. The book is like that as well. Like, it's not... the book is very strange. I only read the first, like, chapter of the book. But I was like, oh. Like, it's written in this very, like, heightened language. That's sort of like... It's sort of preachery, sort of like pseudo-religious. It's got a lot of like these weird undercurrents. So a very strange movie based on a very strange book. Do you recommend Night of the Yes?
Yes.
Is it a good Halloween movie?
Yes.
If anyone's listening to this and it is the morning of Halloween, maybe go rent you up some movies from the local library.
Just all the ones we've watched.
And more. Rent this. It's a good one to throw on, especially if you've never seen it.
No, rent this one and rent The Raven.
Yes. strange little movie. Night of the Hunter, everyone, 1955. Pick up the Criterion Edition 2-disc set. You will have hours of fun just pouring over these.
Depends on who you are.
Depends on who you are. I am just enjoying the heck out of exploring the making of Night of the Hunter.
And I'm not.
Yeah, you're done with it.
Yes.
You're done with it
mm-hmm.
for now.
Yeah, I have other things to do, like all of everything.
Our next movie is...
I don't remember.
I'll give you a hint. Godzilla Roar. It's not a Godzilla movie.
It's the one by the guy who worked closely with the guy who made Godzilla.
Yes, we are doing our first and only, I'm not sure, I haven't looked ahead that far, Akira Kurosawa film, Kurosawa's Throne of Blood.
Oh, is this the one that's like the... No, this is a different one. Never mind.
This is the one that is based on a Shakespeare play.
Oh, Macbeth.
based on Macbeth. The reason it's connected to Godzilla is because, of course, Toho Studios made Kurosawa's films, and Toho Studios also made the Godzilla movies. And Akira Kurosawa and the director of all the Godzilla films were like best friends forever, and they helped each other on each other's movies. They shared a lot of cast members. This movie shares a cast member from Godzilla, but we will not say who just yet, but give us a hint.
Eye patch.
No, a different one. Different.
Oh, right. Not old, eye patch.
Older, and he did not want to
die.
Kill Godzilla.
I was just making that intentionally difficult for you.
You don't remember a thing I say, do you?
No, I knew what you were talking about. I was just making it intentionally difficult for you.
So please, please, please tune in next time when we talk about Kurosawa, when we talk about something I have just, I did the deep dive into this. Can I do a deep dive into Akira Kurosawa in the next few days? Let's find out how much I can learn about Akira Kurosawa, one of the greatest filmmakers.
Well, we're not going to be recording this week.
That's right, because it's Halloween.
Yeah.
Spooky ghosts and
skeletons.
To some also
skeletons.
And witches and
skeletons.
And trick and treating. Who got a rock?
Charlie Brown.
Who didn't get a rock?
Me.
Happy Halloween.
New theme song.
That'll be our next year. That'll be our Halloween theme song. As slow and uncomfortable as that was. That's it.
I couldn't hear what you were saying.
I don't even know how to end this episode. Thank you for listening.
We didn't even start the episode properly.
We did this. We already said I'm Phil and I'm Ollie, and it's El Toro time in the beginning of it. But at the end of the video. In any case, hey everyone, I'm Phil.
And I'm Ollie.
And we'll see you when
it's Del Toro time.
Spooky, scary skeletons and chills down your spine.